From KCRW in Santa Barbara, I'm Jonathan Bastian, and this is the 805, Stories from the Central Coast. This week, a state assemblyman from San Luis Obispo wants to keep the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant open by reclassifying nuclear power as a type of renewable energy. We'll also chat with two local journalists about Santa Barbara's first commercial pot shop, and school board member Laura Capps challenging incumbent Doss Williams for his seat on the Board of Supervisors. But first, the indictment of the now-deceased financier Jeffrey Epstein on charges of sex trafficking brought new attention to a criminal enterprise that exists all over the country. In Santa Barbara County, officials estimate as many as 150 teens in the region have been identified as what they call, quote, commercially sexually exploited children. Earlier this year, law enforcement arrested 22 people in the county on related charges. And these numbers got us wondering, what's being done locally to help the victims of these crimes? That question led us to Sally and Chuck Cook, who have an ambitious plan. In the coming months, they're opening what they say is the largest residential rehab facility in California for women under the age of 21 who have been trafficked. It's called Hope Refuge. While we're not allowed to reveal the exact location of the facility out of safety concerns for the girls, we can say it's high up in the mountains above the Gaviota Coast. The property sits on 214 acres of land with stunning views of the ocean. That's where we meet Sally and Chuck Cook. They give us a driving tour of the property, which was once a boys' summer camp.
So here's the swimming pool. It's a lovely large swimming pool with a swimming house.
And over here's a giant swing. I don't know if you can see that. But yeah, you sit on that little board in the middle and they crank you up with a pulley and let you go.
Over here on the right is an area where we'll be putting the equine therapy. That's one of the most beautiful things about the property is having not just the nature setting, but also the views of Santa Barbara and the views of the ocean. It's just so life-giving. There's really very few places you can go where you don't have something like that.
When the facility is fully up and running later this fall, it'll house 24 girls for six-month stretches. As of now, in the county, there's only one other facility that houses less than 10 girls. We eventually make our way into the dining room, where Sally tells us what inspired her and Chuck to create this place.
Yeah, well, both Chuck and I, we still have our place in LA, and we're both in the entertainment industry. Actually, Chuck was in 2013 working on another nonprofit, but we went to visit a church one Sunday, and there was a guest who just gave an announcement about something, and she declared that the fastest growing industry in the United States of America, criminal industry, is sex trafficking of minors. And then she said the average age of entry is 12 years old. And we just looked at each other and went, that can't be right. She can't have that right. That can't be correct. So we went up to her afterwards and just said, please tell us we heard you wrong. And she was like, no. And started to download a load of information to us about what was happening right on our doorstep in Los Angeles. That kind of ruined us. And we went home shattered, really. It was one of those landmark moments, I think. And spent the next 4 to 6 weeks really kind of doing our own research and study and meeting some survivors and reading their testimonies, their books. And we realized, wow, this really is modern day slavery at its worst.
I mean, there's some pretty interesting statistics. I mean, this is an industry, as you mentioned, that's growing quickly, but not a lot of resources around it or not a lot of beds to support a lot of the young women that have been through incredible amounts of trauma.
Right. Yeah. In 2013, there was a study done in Illinois, actually, nationally. They looked at all the programs that were available for sex trafficked minors, and they found 511 beds. That was all that was available with a program specifically for minors that no one else would take. And that is super concerning, considering we're saying approximately 325,000 a year, and we know we're just scratching the surface, are being trafficked. So we have a crisis on our hands, and it's happening underneath our noses. We don't have any way of finding recovery programs that are quick enough and speedy enough and, you know, have the provision that's actually needed for the level of trauma.
How many beds in Santa Barbara County are available?
Right now we have six. So Santa Barbara is moving. We have six.
That's a lot.
Yes, we have a problem here in California. Six of those beds are here in Santa Barbara, which is amazing. And then our aim is to add 24 to that list. So there'll be 30 in Santa Barbara.
Yeah. So then you, I can tell, I get swept up in what is a major national issue. And then how does it bring us to where we are now in this this huge, beautiful ranch, retreat center, camp. We're standing now in the dining hall, which is where the young ladies, as you mentioned, will have three meals a day.
A friend of mine contacted me, and he basically was kind of sharing with me about this camp that he found and wanted to use it for minors and people at risk. And he's been in the camping business and as a camp leader for many, many years, and just thought that this would be a great facility for that. So in the process of our discussion, I was just asking him questions about the size of the camp. And when he told me there's 125 beds available in this particular camp, I was like, oh my gosh, we could double the amount of beds in America with one swoop. And my naivety at the time, that's how we just jumped in. And we just reached back out to the owners of the facility that was for sale, chatted with them, shared with them our dream and our vision. And his heart was kind of wrecked like ours was. And he went back to his board, and it took a few years for him to convince his board to kind of flip us the keys and try to turn this camp back around for trafficking survivors. And that's kind of where the journey began.
Financially, what did that look like? I mean, this is a big facility. Have you had to raise lots of money, look for grants? I mean, what goes into actually making something like this operational? Because I know that running any type of a retreat or recovery center is an expensive venture.
Yeah, it has been a journey of faith, really, for us. We have been amazed at how the money has come in. So far, we have been able to completely transform this place. I mean, when we look at the man hours, as well as all the resources and gifts in kind that's come in, we're talking close to $1 million, if not more, $1 million that has been put into this place.
When this place is fully operational, what kind of services are you going to provide to 24 girls? That's the plan, right?
It's going to be a short-term residential therapeutic program. So the services will include all the counseling and clinical care that they need to deal with some of the trauma on an individual level, on a group level. They'll have their education up here. There's a lot of medical needs that they have. And then really dealing with coping skills and how to thrive. And so, you know, our aim is just to provide as much of a space as home as you can make a place like this. We've got three cottages that will be running as homes. And then the rest is obviously more communal areas. But the aim is to have that as a homely place where they can get into the deeper, darker areas of their experience and find healing.
Talk about the level of trauma that a young woman can have as they enter a space like this. What are we even talking about?
Well, the story for let's just talk about a general story that a girl may have faced where she's been seduced. It's called grooming. So pimps and traffickers work by grooming a child. And they're working with vulnerable young minds and brains that have not been developed. And what they do is they pursue that child. And they're either as a boyfriend or a father figure or the absent person in their life. You know, they come and fill that gap. And they become everything that that girl or boy needs. And they end up falling in love with this person or creating a very close, what they call trauma bond, an attachment to their perpetrator. And what happens is they can actually groom a child for even up to 6 months until that child is really fully attached. And then they'll start to ask favors. And they might be really small to start with, but it'll cross the line. Unfortunately, the statistics are now showing that between 80 to 90% of trafficked minors have been sexually abused as a child. So there's already this mix of abuse, sex and love, you know, so actually asking them to do sexual favors or strip or dance or to start with isn't that far removed from them. And what starts to happen then, the moment they do, then he'll start to add the pressure on and he'll probably bring her into a group of other girls called a stable. And now all she's trying to do is get that love back. So it might be easy for us to go, well, hang on, as soon as she knows she's being exploited, wouldn't she run? Well, they've got what's called a trauma bond, and that is where what they play on. It's a controlling technique, and they kind of push-pull, and girls and boys will endure a lot of beatings and abuse And they really start to believe the lie about that's being told about them, that they're a bad girl, they've made bad choices, and they've got themselves into a bad situation. So it's their fault. And so there's so much shame attached with sexual exploitation. You know, there's so much self-hate that starts to happen. So when they come off the street, they're deeply connected with the life that they've come from. So their desire is just to get back to that. Their desire is to have what they know is to them, even though it's abusive and exploitive, just like domestic violence, it's safe. You know, it's something they know, should I say, it's something they know. And so trying to work with survivors to expose what's happening to them, you know, they have been exploited, is a journey for them, because it's not easy for them just to admit straight away, oh, I've been exploited. You know, to actually come to that place is what the one person I loved has exploited me. Like, you know, no one else has loved me to this point, and now the one person I thought did has, just imagine. And they're generally coming from vulnerable spaces. So, you know, 65% of them are from the foster care system. So we're already talking about, you know, children who've been displaced from their own families. So they already have that level of trauma. Can you just imagine now all of the extra trauma put on top of that, and our views and ways in which we handle sexual exploitation and prostitution is traumatic. So we're talking layers upon layers upon layers.
Will the girls be coming from Santa Barbara County, LA County? I mean, how do they kind of get to this point to, you know, get the services here?
Initially, we'll be working with the girls that come out of Santa Barbara. We've also reached out to San Luis Obispo and to San Bernardino, our three counties that we're kind of pointing to right now. I mean, Santa Barbara could probably fill us tomorrow. So it's just a matter of, you know, where we reach out to and who do we get involved with, because the need is just huge.
Where are some of these girls in the meantime?
Yeah, just a lot of them are in juvenile hall. Some of them have been sent out of state because there's no facilities in the state of California. And so we'll just get packets on the different girls that are available. And then we go through the process of determining which girls we want to have.
When do you, everything goes to plan, when do you expect the first young ladies to arrive?
Gosh, could be end of October.
Well, Sally and Chuck Cook, thank you for the tour and the time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening.
This is the 805. I'm Jonathan Bastian. We've been reporting on the ongoing story of the scheduled decommissioning of the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Station and what that might mean for the local community in terms of lost revenues and jobs. But there's another element: meeting clean air standards while providing for California's high energy needs. And that has Assemblyman of the 35th District Jordan Cunningham pushing to have nuclear power reclassified as renewable energy, which could keep California's last nuclear power station up and running. Diablo Canyon currently accounts for 9% of the state's energy needs. Jordan Cunningham, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, we've been covering a lot about Diablo Canyon and the plans for a closure, but suddenly it seems like there's some new ideas alive, which could include keeping it open. Tell us about your proposal in the state legislature and where this idea comes from.
Sure. I introduced an assembly constitutional amendment that would make a pretty simple change in law under current law from years back, but also reenacted last year in SB 100, which created our very ambitious targets for renewable portfolio standards for energy. So, you know, the legislature's essentially said that we like certain types of clean energy that don't emit carbon, but other types, specifically nuclear and large-scale hydropower, we don't like. So it's discriminating, if you will, between different types of clean energy. And what my constitutional amendment, were it to pass the legislature, it would put on the ballot for the voters of California to decide whether our renewable portfolio standard for clean energy should include all types of clean energy, which would include nuclear power and large hydro. You know, we've set out some really ambitious targets: 60% renewable energy produced in California by 2030, 100% by 2045. And in my opinion, and I sit on the Utilities and Energy Committee in the Assembly, so I've seen presentations and studied this extensively, we don't have a plan to get there. And it's not going to happen, I think, naturally. And I really think if we're serious about going to completely clean energy for our electricity grid and doing that as part of a climate change strategy to combat climate change, we need to have the conversation about whether nuclear power is part of that portfolio.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, though. I mean, you also represent a lot of folks that could be impacted by the closure of Diablo Canyon. And we know that there is, there's some finances at stake here. I mean, it could be $800 million a year annually, maybe 4,000 jobs lost. There's a lot of different speculation out there. So, I mean, are you interested actually in green energy and a green energy grid, or just trying to keep jobs in your district?
Well, I'm interested in both. I think, you know, jobs are important, and Diablo Canyon Power Plant is the largest private sector employer in my district, and there's over 1,500 people that make a pretty good living. You know, we're talking head of household type jobs working at that power plant. So, you know, of course I've got an interest in preserving jobs in my district, but as to the green energy thing, I that's absolutely important to me. I mean, we, you know, I voted for cap and trade. I mean, I think the climate change strategy needs to be a solid one, and I think we need an above, all of the above type strategy for how we're going to reach those goals. I was talking to the California Energy Commissioner the other day, and he said something that was interesting. If you include current large-scale hydropower and the nuclear-generated electricity we get from Diablo Canyon, we're at about 56% clean energy on average in California. That's pretty close to the 60. But even with large hydro and the last existing nuclear plant, you know, we're only three-fifths of the way to 100%. So what does that mean? That means that when the grid is short electrons, so to speak, the CAISO is buying imported electricity from out of state, and most of the of that electricity is produced from natural gas. So, you know, we've got solar and wind, and that's important investments, geothermal, biomass. I support all that stuff, strong supporter of solar, but you got to be realistic about what that technology can and cannot provide. It's an intermittent power source. When the sun goes down, the production drops to zero of solar. Wind dies down, so the production drops down for wind. And we don't have large-scale storage capacity in California either. So, you know, I'm trying to drive a conversation about, you know, let's get real about whether we can reach these targets and these goals to have a carbon-free energy grid in California without nuclear. And I think the answer is probably no.
Well, let's talk, though, about some of the reasons maybe folks are concerned about a future of nuclear power, specifically the disposal of nuclear waste. From what I can tell, there still isn't really a great plan aside from having to bury it under mountains in Nevada or different places like that. So, I mean, how would you address that? That this is considered an old form of energy, that it seems the consensus in California is that we need to move into the future.
Well, I think, you know, as far as whether nuclear is part of the future, you know, a lot of different countries, including France, produce most of their power from nuclear energy. I mean, that, you know, that's a decision their country's made, in part for environmental reasons. I mean, you're right, there is a storage aspect to it, and the federal government needs to invest some time and energy into coming up with an interim storage facility. I think that's important. And, you know, that's something that needs to be done on the federal level and should have been done, frankly, a long time ago on the federal level. But, you know, everything's got a cost. I mean, if you're going to go to large-scale industrial solar, you know, you've got to have and a storage capacity for that so that the energy that's produced when the sun's out can be stored and used at night, which, by the way, is the peak energy use time for California. Peak demand is actually after the sun goes down because people get home and they turn on their TV and they stream their Netflix shows and they flip the lights on, they cool their house, and and that's when we're producing the least amount of energy. That's not a good situation for our energy grid. But you know, you got to, if you want to do all the solar, you got to have battery storage or some sort of storage, and then you got to dispose of these batteries too. So I mean, there's an environmental cost to all these different forms of energy. I think probably wind energy is probably the most environmentally friendly, and I'm pushing offshore wind off the coast of Morro Bay in my district every way I can. But, you know, these giant turbines, they kill birds. So there's an environmental cost to that, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think nuclear, certainly the storage piece is important. But, you know, we have 452 nuclear reactors throughout the United States of America in operation. There's never been a single death associated with a nuclear power plant ever. And Diablo Canyon has an exemplary, if not perfect, safety record itself. And I think before we lose that energy in the middle of the next decade, and that's coming at a time where we're only, 2025, we're only 5 years away from that 2030 target being a state law. And, you know, the ISO is going to comply with the state law. One way or another, they're going to buy the electrons they need to keep the lights on. And they're probably, unless we make some changes and really give serious examination to keeping the nuclear plant we already have, they're probably going to be buying electrons produced by dirty forms of power. They already do it, and that's kind of the dirty secret of the California energy grid.
We've been speaking with Jordan Cunningham, Assemblyman of the 35th District in San Luis Obispo. Jordan, thanks again for the time.
Thanks for covering this. I really appreciate it.
This is the 805 on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, and to wrap up the week, we're joined by two local journalists. Josh Molina teaches at Santa Barbara City College and writes for NewsHawk, and Jerry Roberts, host on TVSB. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's jump in here. Jerry Roberts, you made a trip to Santa Barbara's first pot shop. We've been discussing cannabis, and there's actually a shop open now, amazingly. And did I hear there's quite a line outside?
Yeah, I went purely for journalistic purposes,
of course.
but it was the middle of the day on Thursday. There was six of us waiting in the ante room to get into the shop, where there was a line through the entire place. You know, I'm loath to make political conclusions from anecdotal evidence, but I would say, you know, that's a plus for Doss Williams, who's being challenged by Laura Capps, the school board member, supervisor Doss Williams, in part on the cannabis issue. And two-thirds of that district is in Santa Barbara, and while there's a lot of people upset in Carp and Montecito about the cultivation, the big question is in Santa Barbara has been, when are their shops going to open?
Right.
So. I thought it was a plus for DOS.
Yeah, well, there again, Jerry Roberts is, as you mentioned, discussing this upcoming Board of Supervisor race where Laura Capps, school board member, is challenging incumbent DOS Williams. Josh Molina, there was speculation about this, I mean, really, for months. She made it official this week. Your thoughts on how this is shaping up, kind of considering what Jerry said, too, that cannabis is going to be the central issue here.
Yeah, so Laura Capps finally announced, everyone knew that she was thinking seriously about it, and she decided that she was going to do it. She held a big event at the Rose Garden by the Mission. She's way behind, though, here, so she's sort of hoping that her campaign will capture a little bit of synergy. It'll have some energy. It'll be sort of a perfect storm moment, with the cannabis storm being sort of the thing that made her jump into the race. But DOS has already raised tons of money, and Laura Capps just formed her fundraising committee. She will have people who will give her money, but at this event, she tried really hard to separate herself from just being the cannabis, mm-hmm. the anti-cannabis candidate, and be the candidate for families. She's going to have a rough road ahead because, as we know, DOS Williams was first elected in Santa Barbara in 2003. He was elected twice. He came in first the second time he was elected, and he's very popular. He's been on the ballot, in some kind of ballot, since 2003. So he's got the edge, but Laura Capps is sort of hoping that she can ride this perfect moment in time, mm-hmm. where she can oust him. It's a very difficult task. We have to see how it's going to play out over the next few months.
Jerry Roberts.
Well, Josh is right that she needs to build a message that goes beyond cannabis. And she didn't really, I think, accomplish that at the event. She talked about trustworthiness and integrity, and there were a lot of sort of inferential shots at Doss Williams because he's taken a lot of money, over $30,000, from marijuana growers at the time he was helping to craft the ordinance. So that's an issue. But it was more of a passive-aggressive attack, and I think if you're going to take out an incumbent, you need to make the case against the incumbent. Now, they got a poll in their pocket that they did recently that shows her actually leading in a one-on-one with DOS. The Caps brand is a nice, kind of Midwestern nice brand. It's hard for her to go on the attack. So I think they're kind of torn about whether she's going to attack or run as the front runner. But in any case, she's got to broaden that message out beyond DOS did a bad job in cannabis.
All right, we're going to be following that race pretty closely. Josh Molina, too, another thing that kind of caught my attention, which is that two Santa Barbara City Council members, this is Megan Harmon and Oscar Gutierrez, They've been reappointed to council after being appointed the first time, which none of that really makes any sense when I say it, but explain what's going on here.
Yeah, Oscar was elected and Megan was appointed, but since we moved to district elections, we are seeing fewer people who are running for these seats. Here we have two opportunities for people to run to represent Santa Barbara, and the only people who decided to run were the people who were already in those seats. So it's really points to that larger debate about should the city have gone to district elections. Their whole argument was that people don't run because they can't afford to, it's too big, they can't run a campaign across the city. And so then we get people in this golden triangle of the Riviera, San Roque, the Mesa, who are representing Santa Barbara. So now we've split up the city and we have districts where no one's deciding to run. So that's not really good for competition. You want people to challenge Oscar Gutierrez, you want people to challenge Megan Harmon, and maybe they are the best people for the seat, but I don't know how we really know that unless somebody steps up. The council was considering extending the time when someone could apply, but decided not to. So it's kind of a tough situation. There are people qualified all over the city who would love to serve on the council, but they don't live in these districts, so right. They're not running.
And I should say, you know, the reason that council is appointing them both is because there were no challengers, and this way they can save money by not holding elections. Jerry Roberts, I mean, how do you make sense of this, kind of in the greater context of these?
Well, you know, it looked at more broadly, part of the reason that we have district elections because of the Voting Rights Act, which was supposed to give representation to underrepresented communities, and we now have three members of the Latinx community on the city council. So I think you have to look at that and say, you know, that's kind of a win. On the other hand, I think one thing it's done is really strengthened the importance of the Democratic Party endorsement. And both Oscar and Megan Harmon are endorsed by the party. And they just, in small races where a little bit of money goes a long way, that's just an outsized advantage. And I think that's part of the reason that people didn't run. And I think there's a growing concern that there's, you know, a lot more partisanship on what's technically and constitutionally supposed to be a nonpartisan office.
I would just say that, you know, that whole point about increasing Latino representation is a good one. Kathy Murillo, the mayor, was elected before district elections. But, you know, we have to be careful not to be in a situation where we are limiting the pool of people who could run. So maybe next time district elections, next time there's an election, there's it's more incumbent on the city to widely promote that, hey, it's a new way of doing things and you need to run, you need to step up, because maybe people just didn't know. Maybe there are people who wanted a challenge for this seat, but did not. Oscar Gutierrez has a 5-year term because the city's moving to even year elections. So there are a lot of things to consider here. It's not really easy. There are not a lot of obvious answers, but at the end of the day, two people are getting appointed to their seats. And by the way, they voted on their own reappointments. Megan Harmon abstained. Oscar voted for himself to get reappointed. That's worth thinking about whether that's the right system.
Jerry?
Just real quickly, I would just add, there are two very competitive races for other district seats going on at the same time. On the east side, incumbent Jason Dominguez being challenged by Alejandro Gutierrez, who's runs a nonprofit, and Crisito Cruz, who's kind of a perennial candidate. So that's an open race. And then on the Mesa in the second district, Randy Rouse, a council member, is termed out, and there are five people running for that. I had them all on my show last night. It's a very lively group and very competitive. So there's still some work for political reporters.
All right. That's Jerry Roberts and Josh Molina joining us here on the 805. Guys, thanks for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it for today. You've been listening to the 805 on KCRW in Santa Barbara. You can learn more about the show at kcrw.com/the805 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show was produced by Carolina Starin. I'm Jonathan Bastian. We'll see you next week.